So how much to the Buddha, how much to the Dharma, how much to the Sangha? So today's talk, I'm calling Sustainable Bodhisattva Practice, Bearing Witness, Taking Care, Taking Action. So being a bodhisattva in a world of immense suffering, how do we stay true to our vows and our aspirations, but in a way that doesn't overwhelm us, burn us out, lead to despair, etc.? So I did 3 podcast episodes on this in February this year. So just like I had the 9 fields, I also came up with this formulation that I called Crisis Buddhism. So this was before the pandemic caused lockdowns here on the west coast of the U.S. And my primary concern when I was formulating Crisis Buddhism was the breakdown of the Earth's natural life support systems and global heating. So that was kind of the crisis that I had in mind as I was formulating this particular approach to practice. But then we ended up in the middle of the pandemic. And it's easy to lay blame on, and we should hold our leaders accountable. But no matter what, no matter how we were to deal with this pandemic, it's a awful situation. There's just, no matter how wonderful a leadership we had, there still would be a lot of suffering going on right now. And then, ironically, then I was formulating Crisis Buddhism, and I was right at the point where I was talking about taking action and how you should, you know, get out. Like, literally, I said, this doesn't mean just giving money, which is fine. This means getting out of your house, interacting with other people, and doing something. And then there was a lockdown. So, you know, it's a different kind of crisis. And then, just when we thought things couldn't get any crazier, just when our headlines are already crammed with awful news, then, of course, another unarmed black man, George Floyd, was killed by a law enforcement officer. And this isn't a remarkable incident. This happens with an incredible frequency. And as I've heard pointed out, these are just the incidences that get filmed so we can see them and prove what happened. And the ones that come to our attention are the ones where people died. So there's many other situations where people are just injured or abused that don't even show up on our radar. So I don't know how many of you have watched the video of George Floyd being killed. I felt some responsibility to watch it, but it is traumatic. I mean, this officer, you know, a lot of times the excuses in these situations is that the officer feared for his life. And I think what was so remarkable and so incendiary about this particular instance was it was so clear that this officer had the advantage and was just kneeling on this guy's neck, you know, for a total of 8 minutes. A couple minutes after the guy lost consciousness, there's other cops around, the guy's handcuffed. You know, it's just so clear. So then, of course, you know, many of our cities have experienced violent protests and looting, peaceful protests as well, but they don't attract nearly the attention. All during the, you know, after George Floyd was killed, I was looking in the New York Times for some, because that's the newspaper I subscribe to. I was looking online, and I was looking for information about it. And it didn't show up on the main landing page for the paper until the violent protests and looting started. Then it showed up. Then it was at the top, even above the coronavirus. So faced with all of this madness, all of this suffering, all of these tricky situations, what does it mean to be a bodhisattva? So our vows, bodhisattva vows, our beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. So in Mahayana Buddhism, in Zen, we believe that it not only is it impossible for us to attain complete peace of mind, liberation, you know, whatever spiritual goal you might set, it's impossible for us to attain that without taking care of others. But not just impossible in the sense that you won't really be able to achieve it unless you are altruistic, but really that, like, that's an oxymoron. That's like being in the same boat with everybody, but somehow hoping to get to the shore before everybody else. That, like, we are all in this together. We're all interdependent. So liberation for one person is liberation for all people. It's there. It goes together. So this is a lovely ideal. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. But what does this actually mean to us as individuals? What does it mean in our daily lives? We can't save all beings. We can't end human suffering and conflict. We think things are bad now, but we're deluding ourselves if we think our ancestors had it better. They didn't. The world has always been going to hell in a handbasket. I mean, personally, I think that with the climate crisis, we really are this time, but that's what every generation has thought, right? Now it really is falling apart. So really, this is part of the truth that Buddhism is grounded in, is the undeniability of the presence of greed, hate, and delusion and suffering in the human world, that there always has been and always will be. Now, this doesn't mean that we can't improve things, of course, because in many ways we have it better than our ancestors. We have antibiotics. Many of us would be dead already if we lived only 100 years earlier. As a woman, I wouldn't be in this role. I wouldn't have had the life that I had at all. But we will never actually experience, as individuals or as a society, the literal fulfillment of our bodhisattva vow to save all beings, to end all delusions. And this is a vow we take in all seriousness, a vow that resonates deep in our hearts. It's a vow that makes life worth living. And yet, we'll never, ever achieve it. So how do we honor it in a meaningful way, as opposed to just holding on to it as some kind of abstract ideal that seems to have little application in our everyday lives and in our society? So basically, we focus on our practice, not on outcomes. So what are we going to do? What decisions are we going to make? What aspects of body, speech, and mind are we going to cultivate? What bodhisattva actions are we going to take? We base our practice on our bodhisattva vow wholeheartedly. the fact that literal fulfillment of the vow is impossible doesn't enter into it. So this is one of my favorite stories. It's from the Tibetan Buddhist scripture called the Mani Kaboom. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but in it, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. This is a mythological story. So Avalokiteshvara is seen as the embodiment of compassion. So the Bodhisattva looks out, uses his supernatural powers, and is able to look out over and see all beings and see the state of all beings. And he's deeply grieved. He says, their desires are like the waterfall. Their hatred is like a blazing fire. Their ignorance shrouding them like clouds of darkness. Their pride is as solid as the mountain. And their jealousy is as rapid as the wind. The chain of self or ego ties each and every sentient being to the cycle of birth and death. So he made a vow to liberate all sentient beings without leaving anyone behind. And in he vowed, he said, if I have any self-clinging, if I turn back from this purpose, may my head crack into pieces. So then the Bodhisattva works tirelessly, saving countless beings. And he does this for who knows how long, right? It's a mythological Bodhisattva, so it's probably eons. And then he uses his supernatural powers to look back over beings and see his progress. And he sees that the number of suffering beings has not decreased at all. And he feels so much despair that he thinks, I gotta give up. I mean, at least I'll liberate myself. And then, of course, his head cracks into 100 pieces because of his vow. So fortunately, the Buddha Amitabha put it back together for him. But what he did was he gave Avalokiteshvara 11 heads in order to be able to have the capacity to look in all directions and absorb and witness all of this suffering. And one of those heads is wrathful. Not just nice, but wrathful when some sentient beings need that kind of reaction. And he also, the Bodhisattva asked, he said, well, if I'm going to do this, can I also have 1,000 arms and 1,000 eyes? So this is where you see the image of Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 arms, and in the middle of the palm of each hand, there's an eye. So Amitabha then warned the Bodhisattva, saying, there is no end to the world of suffering. You must benefit sentient beings until the world of suffering ends. So, here is our impossible, impossible situation. There is no end to the world of suffering. You must benefit sentient beings until the world of suffering ends. So we do this by focusing on our practice and not on outcomes. So this is also reflected in the book Active Hope, which we studied a ways back at Bright Way. Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone, it's called Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And they emphasize in that hope, if we're hoping for some kind of positive outcome, will almost always be disappointed and discouraged. But if we focus on being active for what we hope for in the world, that can be a source of great strength. It can be a sustainable and positive way to be. So this isn't just focusing on our personal lives, our comfort, security, and pleasure. It's not just giving up washing our hands of responsibility because we don't think there's really anything that we can do. Nothing we can do that's going to make a big enough difference. It's being active for what we hope for in the world. But what does this mean? What does this entail, right? I mean, most of us hear that. I should be active for what I hope for in the world. I should be doing some bodhisattva activity, whatever. And we come up with a huge list of reasons why we can't. I can't find anything to do. I'm too busy. I don't have enough time. I struggle with health issues. I have responsibilities to my family. There's a whole litany of reasons why we can't take action in the world, that we can't be active for what we hope for in the world. But none of these are legitimate excuses. So the bodhisattva path is for all of us. So in our morning chant on Sundays, we include this line, which is from the Lotus Sutra. Even little children in their play, who gather sand and make it into stupas, all such beings have fulfilled the Buddha way. So if making a sand stupa with the right attitude is consistent with this bodhisattva action, then we need to think outside of those limited ideas that we have about what taking action really means. But practically speaking, how do we do this? And that's what my formulation of crisis Buddhism was meant to address. So in my vision, there are three parts to our practice: bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. So for our practice to be fruitful, honest, growing, developing, for our hearts to be open as possible, to for us to be free as much as possible from cognitive dissonance, which is when our behavior is out of sync with what we believe. So if we have a vow to save all sentient beings and we're not enacting that, we're not behaving in that way, we experience cognitive dissonance. It's a sense of things not being right. It's a particular brand of dukkha. So if all we can have our practice be most fruitful and vital and be free from cognitive dissonance, when all three of these areas are present in our practice. But at different times and different situations, each area may wax or wane. Then we may, if we're, you know, suffering a health crisis and our family is experiencing conflict, the taking care part might be very all-consuming. At other times, we might be able to emphasize more one of the other areas. But I would say no one should conclude that one of these areas isn't for them, because how we practice within them takes many different forms. We can always find a way to honor each area in some way within our particular life situation and capacities. So bearing witness, it's a lot of what we're doing right now. And seeing that as part of our practice, recognizing it as valuable bodhisattva work in and of itself, I think can be very, very encouraging and focusing for us. So the meaning of the name Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, also known as Kanon or Kanzeon or Kuan Yin, is the one who hears the cries of the world. So there is an understanding that out of compassion, the Bodhisattva responds, but it's like the most important aspect of the Bodhisattva's activity is just presence. That Avalokiteshvara hears, witnesses. She sees your suffering. She's with you in your suffering. Now, oftentimes we find it difficult to witness suffering when we can't do anything about it. If we can't fix it and make it go away, it can end up feeling like it's pointless to experience the pain or discomfort of witnessing it. But bearing witness as a practice asks us to set that all aside, to expose ourselves to the world's suffering. And that's not just the news, although it includes the news. It's also the suffering of friends and family, community members. It's learning and watching and reading and experiencing in many, many different ways. And all of this informs our decisions. You know, so there's that sense that, you know, if I need to read the news so I make, you know, so I know how to vote and I know how to make my decisions as a citizen and things like that. But as a practice, I want to make the point that this is valuable in and of itself. Even if it's not about informing your decisions, even if it doesn't translate into any kind of effort to fix anything, even if you can't do anything to fix the situation. Just witnessing another's suffering so they're not alone in it is part of our practice. But bearing witness can be hard. It can take an emotional toll or even traumatize us. It can exhaust us, get us all agitated, angry, or whatever. So that's why we balance this area with the next area, which is taking care. So we're balancing taking care of ourselves and our practice, our emotional well-being with bearing witness. So we notice that was enough. I've witnessed enough for now. I need to go take a walk. We have a privileged situation even to be able to do that, but there it is. Go out in the garden, enjoy time with loved ones, something. So to balance the bearing witness with taking care. But it's not a permanent break, right? So I've heard a lot of people say, and I totally sympathize, you know, people who like, they don't watch the news anymore. They don't expose themselves anymore because they do, when they do, it's just discouraging. It just makes them upset. Just, you know, but then we're neglecting this area of practice, which keeps our heart open, which is participating in the human race. So we can take a break, take care of ourselves, take care of our practice, and then when we're able to make some space for bearing witness again. So taking care, I think, I don't know, we probably all have areas where we can improve at this, but we probably all do a somewhat decent job of this. It means practically taking care of ourselves and our lives, as well as spiritual care. So, you know, Zazen and our Sangha time and our Dharma study and our practice is also taking care. And I don't know about you, but I found it useful when I think of my practice in terms of these three areas and about balancing them. Because if I know I am going to be making space for bearing witness and taking action, then when I'm taking care, I don't have to feel guilty about taking care. taking care is all part of the whole process. Taking care is so that I can bear witness and take action. Taking care isn't a self-centered thing. It's part of a larger package. So for me, it's enabled me to relax more into that when I'm doing things that are regenerative and sustaining for myself. And then, of course, there's taking action. Not just giving money, but doing something in our embodied practice. And no one's contribution is too small. Something. How do we gather sand and make it into a stupa? What does that mean? And what ways do you serve? And when we contemplate this, we don't want to shame ourselves. Don't shame yourself. Don't feel like you are being shamed. That's not helpful. Like, you're not doing enough. You should do more. That's really not helpful. You can look at what you're already doing in your life. How is your bodhisattva vow manifested? In what ways do you operate? What actions do you take that you do so because you want to bring about a more peaceful and just world, that you want there to be love and respect, that you want everyone to feel cared for, that you want your families and family members and friends to live positive and happy lives. So, you know, there's the tricky part of, on the one hand, we look at our lives and we try to find what we're already doing and not feel ashamed or guilted into doing something more. But on the other hand, our practice is about being honest and about constantly questioning ourselves. So we also need to ask, are we doing enough? Are we doing all we can? And it's not about somebody else asking you that and evaluating your life and judging you, but really you sincerely asking yourself, is there something more that I can do to bring about what I hope for in the world? Now, just take a note here to say that sometimes we resist taking action because we want, this is a self-confession partly, we want our actions to be really impactful. Like, if we're going to spend our precious time and energy and resources on something, we want to be sure that it really makes a difference and that makes a substantial difference. That's not a waste of time. And this can keep us from finding something to do because we're holding out for something that we know is really going to be it. But if you really look at it, like, even the grandest actions are drops in the bucket. You know, we may idealize Martin Luther King, but even he just did a piece and didn't solve every problem in the world. So in that sense, I just say, you know, we're doing something, some small piece satisfies this aspect of our practice. So obviously, there's a lot more to be said about that kind of stuff. So I want to get a little bit more specific. This is an opportunity. Not only do I want to talk about this because of the subject matter, but also for it to be an opportunity for us as a Sangha to do a little bearing witness, little practice of this. So many people of color, when asked by white people what we can do to be allies, to help combat racism, they ask us to educate ourselves. To educate ourselves, not just about racism as a phenomenon that has happened in society and is unjust, but about whiteness, about what it means to be a white person in this system. And I will look around this virtual room here and see that, as far as I can tell, we're all white. I may be wrong, and I apologize if anybody out there identifies differently. But it's pretty frequent in Zen circles that you can look around the room and everybody's white. So what we did at Bright Way a little over a year ago was a cohort of us went through a series called Awakening to Whiteness. And it's a version of a course that's also offered in other circles called White Awake. So it's really four white people. It's very educational. It's about examining our own assumptions and responses. There's a lot of reading. So my confession in terms of going through this course was that I didn't know why it was important. I didn't think I needed it. I'm like, I knew that there was slavery in the US and, you know, it was terrible. It, you know, ended about 150 years ago. And since then, people sometimes have been prejudiced and really mean. But not much more than that. And like most people, I didn't feel like I had a racial identity. I mean, if I was to have a white racial identity, that would be like white supremacy. Like, that's creepy, right? I'm just no race, right? People of color have a race. I have no race. So the course really is about challenging that assumption and helping us see how simply falling into this socially constructed category of whiteness, which until very recently was actually written into many, many laws. Like, it's not just an imaginary concept. It was actually a legal concept in many circumstances. The consequence of being born into that social category has had an enormous impact on our lives. We're not really aware of it. The course also taught me I realize many of you may have already knew this, right? But I'm confessing that I didn't. It taught me that there's been a relentless, ongoing, extreme, overt oppression of Black people in the United States since slavery ended. And that, of course, includes there's other kinds of oppression that have happened with Native Americans and Mexicans and Asians in different shapes and forms. But specifically about African Americans, when the slaves were released, so this is where some of our bearing witness comes in. When the slaves were released, they were freed with absolutely nothing. Nothing. They had no money. They had no property. Who was going to hire them or loan them money or help them out? So they were completely and utterly destitute and therefore frequently just roped back in to forms of indentured servitude. Just, you know, all right, now you can stay on that property and farm it and give us the proceeds and you'll always owe us for being on the land. So you just stay there. I mean, is the situation's better than slavery, but still very limited. And to keep poor and working class Blacks and whites from uniting against the ruling class, there emerged the pseudoscientific rationale for racism. So there'd been some of this before, but it really came to be after the Civil War. Where it's pseudoscientific stuff about like skull sizes and body mechanics and all this kind of stuff, proving the inferiority of people of color. And this was a completely acceptable topic of conversation for polite people and public media and newspapers. This was like what we would just sit down over Thanksgiving dinner and discuss this pseudoscientific, did you know? So this went on for, you know, 50 to 100 years, probably more. Perfectly acceptable and fascinating topic for white people. And then, of course, when blacks started achieving any kind of wealth or power or freedom in the late 1800s and early part of the 20th century, lynching was widespread and common. Any person of color knew that if they stepped out of line, if they offended a white person in any way, if they competed with a white person in any way, if they looked at them wrong, they could be killed publicly and without any repercussions whatsoever for their killers. And in frequent circumstances, whole towns turned out to watch and cheer it on. So you can understand that, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people were killed in this way, but it's not even about the numbers. If you just know that's a possibility, that puts a huge cramp in your style. So everybody knows, throughout most of the last century, apartheid was perfectly legal until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, only 56 years ago, within the living memory of some Black Americans, keeping Black people excluded from most of the places and opportunities enjoyed by white people. And redlining, which I am embarrassed to have never heard about before this course, or I don't remember anyway, excluded people of color from buying homes except in certain designated ghetto areas. And it was rare for them to even be able to get a loan for a mortgage. So if they did manage to get a mortgage and buy a home, they defined the value of homes in a particular area. They devalued it by the number of people of color that lived in that area. So the more people of color that moved into an area, the more the home values went down. It was part of the calculation. So therefore, even if people of color were able to get a mortgage and able to buy a home, they weren't able to grow their wealth the way white people could, because then their home value would just go down because they were Black. So that, you know, much of that overt stuff at least was ended by the Civil Rights Act in 1964. But then that's been replaced. It's like every time the method of oppression ends up shifting or becoming ineffective for some reason, some new method is employed. So this was replaced by essentially the neoliberalism of the 80s, 70s and 80s, right? So now you look at Black Americans, and they're living in areas with high crime and poverty, and you say that's their fault. Neoliberalism as the merit-based, you know, how much you have is based on your merit. So if you don't have a lot, then it's your own fault in some way. So that leads then to a sense of, particularly around Black men, the cultural presumption of guilt and dangerousness. And this is incredibly toxic. This is what has led to mass incarceration and this brutal policing. So I think my bearing witness as I went through this course really shifted my whole sense of race relations in our country. And so when I see this explosion of rage in looting and riots, you know, it's not excusable by any means, but it's understandable. It's sad, But until things got violent and ugly, how much attention were we paying? I saw a very, very touching monologue by Trevor Noah. It's on YouTube, that he put out just his, he's quarantining at home and just sitting on his couch and speaking freely. And he talked about the riots and how we feel kind of shocked and traumatized when we see people just, you know, breaking windows and stealing stuff. And he talks about how, you know, society is a social contract we have with one another. It's how we're going to behave. And he, as he pointed out, like there's people in our country that they have so little, they're living on the street. They're living in a tent on the street, but they don't go break windows and steal stuff because they're still part of them is living according to this social contract. But he said, if you see the social contract, like you're not, the other parties in the social contract aren't keeping up their end of the bargain. If the cops don't have to follow any laws when they're dealing with you, why should you follow any laws? Why should you keep the social contract? So when we do the practice of bearing witness, we just hold all of this and witness it without trying to jump into blame or problem solving. Or I mean, naturally we want to take action and we want to be responsible, but there's a value in just attending to all of this with as open a heart as we can. And I want to make a suggestion that sometimes these different areas can overlap. So taking action and bearing witness can overlap in something like the Awakening to Whiteness course. In the course, you are bearing witness, but it also involves taking some action, right? Making some commitment, doing some study, doing some interacting with other people. And that may not seem like much, but it is something. And since that course, I've had myself much more humility, patience, and willingness around discussions about race. And I think perhaps the most important thing, which is really consistent with Buddhism, I know more about what I don't know. I know how much I don't know. So in conclusion, we must not turn away from our bodhisattva vows, even though the world is on fire. It's always been on fire. At the same time, we can practice crisis Buddhism, carefully balancing bearing witness, taking care, taking action. So our bodhisattva practice is lively and authentic, but sustainable. And then when it gets really tough, let's remember that there was a moment when even Avalokiteshvara couldn't handle it. And his determination flagged and his head broke into 100 pieces. And then maybe if you picture him reassembled with his 11 heads and his 1,000 arms and his 1,000 eyes, that maybe it's like each one of us is, you know, one of those arms or one of those eyes. And that we really can't face the suffering of the world by ourselves. That we can only face it and respond to it as part of a larger organism. Each of us doing our small part. comments or questions.
I just want to say that Trevor Noah video, I watched that too. I posted it. It's incredible, and it's incredibly insightful, and I highly recommend it to everyone to check out.
Thanks, Matt, for posting those.
Thank you. That was very powerful, Tomio, and really necessary. Thank you very much.
Hear me?
Okay.
It's very quiet.
Bearing witness, well, first, it's kind of like I grew up in a Jewish family in West Virginia when I was young. And so, in a way, I wasn't a white person. We were those people and the Christ killers and dirty Jews. I got beat up. They took my lunch money, you know, that kind of stuff. But I could pass. So it's not the same thing. You know, it's not the same thing. But one thing, when you grow up in a Jewish family, and I know certain temples are different, when you're a little kid, they show you videos of the Holocaust and photographs, and you see that, and they say, never forget, never forget, never forget. And they, you know, make sure you teach the children, never forget this happened, so it won't happen again in the future, you know. But it was traumatizing to me as a child. It was too much bearing witness as a child. And I kind of developed a complex about it. And what's interesting about it is back in those days when I was when I killed Jesus and I was the dirty Jew and all of that, I don't remember killing Jesus, frankly, but, you know, apparently that's what the kids told me. The black kids, they didn't treat me like that. They didn't like welcome me in and like, you know, but they were never like that because I was in a majority black schools where we live too. So it was the white kids that excluded me, and the black kids that they were like, oh, we see what's happening to you because that's what happens to us every day too. So, yeah, I feel like I've got a kind of a unique viewpoint on that because of that experience growing up. But yeah, sometimes I feel like my head broke into 100 pieces a few times. And so sometimes we need to step back, and sometimes we need to step back from, I've heard it called murder porn. We need to stop sharing that video because, you know, we're re-traumatizing that family, and re-traumatizing the black community. So I really want to thank you, Domio, for sharing that particular story and that particular part of the story of the head breaking into 100 pieces, because I totally, totally resonate with that. We can take action, but you know what? We can't traumatize ourselves.
Did you want to say something, Ruth Ann?
Yes. This morning on the radio, OPB, I heard this Somali family, a couple of generations, that had their family little restaurant burn to the ground in Minneapolis. And they said, as bad as this is, this does not compare to George losing his life. Mm. And I was so touched by, I mean, their voices, their conversation, you could hear the couple generations of this family looking at the rubble. But there was no rancor in, and it was so touching. And for me, I take action in educating myself and sharing with others how the being white privileged, I mean, racism is systemic globally.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've reached 12:15. So if anybody wants to drop off, that is fine. Bows to you, but I thought we'd stay on for another 5 to 10 minutes if people have anything else that they want to say.